it in gold as surety against the trade with Raus, and greed and pride won out, they would take the risk. We were 4 days riding with Neki's family, following the Lusande west toward the harsh stony hills of outlying Kushith. The Lusande Valley is lush and rich in the center of the province, and we saw a fair number of folk as we traveled. The Tsingani traded with them, mending pots and horseshoes in exchange for wine and foodstuffs. Sometimes we saw nobles and their retinues, house guards in gleaming Kushaline devices, but we had no fear of discovery. With Neki's family our disguise was complete, more than it would have been even with Manorge's riders. Jocelyn performed for small crowds more than once, growing confident in his mendicant's trade, while the children went among the spectators with tins, begging copper coins. I had a quiet word with Gisela to ensure that no purses were lifted. If we landed before the judiciary, our quest would be in vain. It was a strange thing to sojourn with an eloquent Carceline and a quiet Tsingano. I spoke with Hyacinth the first night, the others leaving us to it in privacy. "You could still go back, you know," I said, sitting beside him. "When this is done, Manoj would take you back, I think. They like to forgive." Hyacinth shook his head. "No," he said softly. "He never forgave my mother, you know, for all his tears. Some things are unforgivable. Murder, theft, treachery. But not that which is Vrajna. I knew this. I was swept up in it, Fedra. I'd never known what it was like to have such a family. So many folk to call cousin and aunt and near brother." "I know." I slipped my hand into his. "Believe me, I do know." So much to say at such a time, and none of it adequate. We sat like that for a long time. Hyacinth put his arm about me and laid my head on his shoulder, falling at length into the white exhaustion that follows strong emotion, until at last I slept and dreamed I was awake. At least I did not dream of Melisande, which I had feared. Hyacinth's presence kept those dreams at bay. So I slept, and woke to find it morning, and Hyacinth still asleep, the two of us entwined like twins, my hair spread like a silken drape across his chest. Someone had laid a blanket over us. I sat up blinking at the daylight. Across the camp, Jocelyn glanced at me and politely looked away. Hyacinth stirred, waking. It was hard to leave the warmth of him. I fumbled for Isandra's signet on its chain beneath my dress, beneath the deadly weight of Melisande's diamond. A mission for the Queen. That, above all else. Our caravan moved slowly, the pace dictated by the Tsingani wagon, which was not built for speed. But by the third evening we left behind the rich spring valleys for the rocky terrain of Outer Kushith. And on the fourth day our progress was torturously slow, as the wagon had to be pushed at times. The children bounced shrieking in the back, while all the men, Neki, his brother-in-law and cousin, Hyacinth and Jocelyn alike, set their backs to it and shoved, grunting. But when we made camp that night, we could smell salt air. I had taken our landmarks from atop the tallest hill and studied them against the map Isandra had provided us, a luxury after the Skaldic wilderness. Jocelyn gazed over my shoulder. "There," I said, pointing. "The Pointe d'Ouest lies there. Raus's fleet is quartered 3 miles to the north. If we take the road that runs just south of that ridge, we should reach him before noon."
"Good." Hunkering on his heels, Jocelyn sifted a handful of dirt through his hand. Opening his hand, he showed me the thin, pale grass sprouts taking root even in the rocky soil. "Spring's coming even here," he said softly. "How long do you think Voldemar Selig will wait?"
"We're months from the first harvest."
Fear made my heart beat faster.
"He can't possibly be provisioned, and he'll wait for that."
"Not so far off." Jocelyn lifted his head, staring toward the darkening west. "And we've a long way to go."
"Tomorrow," I said, and repeated it more firmly. "We'll reach Quintilius Raus tomorrow."
And indeed so we should have done, except that it was not to be.
Perhaps we had grown overconfident, secure in our disguise, travelling unimpeded the breadth of Cushith. But truly, I think, it would not have mattered. The guard that stopped us was there for a purpose, and they would have stopped any travellers, Tsingani or royal courier alike. Labouring over a hillcrest, we didn't see them until we were nigh upon them, and one of the children shouted out a warning.
Dodi Ma! Gavaroti!
A squadron of 20 guardsmen arranged across the road waiting for us. Behind them, a mile off, we could see the grey sea wrinkling. The day was overcast, and the light glinted dully on their armour. A breeze lifted the standard-bearer's flag. I knew its device, echoed on their livery. I had seen it in another time and place. A raven and the sea. The arms of the Duke de Morban. Spurring his horse, Hyacinth rode quickly to the head of the caravan. This much we had discussed. Better that he should be our spokesman than Jocelyn or I, who might be marked as unusual.
"Where are you bound, Tsingano?"
The leader of the guard invested the word with scorn. I noticed it more now. "We have an agreement to trade with the Queen's Admiral," Hyacinth said reasonably. "May we pass, my lord?" The leader of the guard turned his head and spat upon the ground.
"The Queen's Admiral sails where he will, but this is Morban. No one crosses without the Duke's permission. You'll wait on his grace."
In point of truth, we'd been crossing Morban for some time now. It is the sovereign duchy of Cushith, and vast. I understood. It was access to the Queen's Admiral that Quinsel de Morban was controlling. Hyacinth turned back as if to survey our party, meeting my eyes briefly. I gave an imperceptible nod. We dared not try to fight our way through, not with the rest of Morban's troops a mere mile or two away. "Then we will wait," Hyacinth said calmly. So wait we did, while de Morban's men idled and a rider headed south. The adult Tsingani was scared, but bore it well. The children, our best disguise, carried the act for us. One of the little girls found a nest of baby rabbits, which kept them all occupied. And in short order, Quinsel de Morban appeared, with a second squadron of his houseguard. 40 armed men now. If ever we'd had a chance of fighting clear, it was gone now. I kept my head low, watching him through my lashes. I remembered him, tall and lean, with features that had the same harsh beauty as the terrain he ruled, ruthless and hard. Greying sandy hair, and eyes the colour of iron, a dark grey without warmth. I remembered his sharp banter with Melisande on the longest night, and how he had touched me beneath the sheer diamond-spangled gauze.
"You seek passage through my lands?" he asked without preface, his tone tinged with irony. "What do the Tsingani want with a sailor?"
Hyacinth bowed. "Your Grace de Morban, we have an agreement to trade with the Queen's Admiral."
"Since when does a sailor need a horse?"
De Morban's keen gaze swept over our group, resting on Jocelyn.
"What in Elowa's name is that?"
"Your Grace."
Jocelyn dismounted, bowing with an elaborate flourish that set his cloak to swirling in a riot of colour.
"I am but a humble mendicant, born in Marsilico's city. If you would be entertained, I will tell you of how I came to—"
"Enough,"
de Morban cut him off with a word, settling wearily into the saddle.
"I've no time to waste with tail-spinners. So Quintilius Rouse thinks to build himself a horse patrol, does he?"
The grey eyes narrowed.
"Perhaps I might make a better offer for these creatures, Tsingano. What do you say to that?"
A murmur of excitement arose among Neki's family, but Hyacinth shook his head as if in sorrow.
"Alas, your grace, I gave my word to the Admiral. I swore it upon my own mother's spirit. May she rest in peace."
De Morban crossed his hands, resting them on his pommel.
"Did you?" he asked wryly. "And what is a Tsingano's word worth? Double Rouse's offer, perhaps?"
Another murmur, quickly hushed, from Neki's folk.
"Perhaps,"
Hyacinth said slyly. "Perhaps we may trade somewhat with your grace. A token for our passage, mayhap." He shifted his horse. "This steed I ride, your grace, is a fine one. Could you use such a mount?"
"Raus must be offering a great deal."
De Morban's face was unreadable.
"No, I don't think so, Tsingano. It's not in my interest to see the Admiral horsed. But I'll play you fair. I'll pay his price and more."
Hyacinth spread his arms and shrugged. "As your grace wishes. I ask only that you allow me to convey my regrets to the Admiral and beg his forgiveness." He closed his arms and shuddered, putting a tremor in his voice. "For if you do not, my mother's mulo will ride the night winds and plague my sleep forevermore," he added pitiably. It was a good performance. I dare say most people would have bought it, but Cuchulines are suspicious by birth, and Quinsel de Morban had not held his duchy by being a fool. He sat in his saddle and surveyed our motley band, then slowly shook his head.
"No, Tsingano, I think not. Unless there's somewhat else you'd like to tell me."
"My lord," Jocelyn's voice rang out. Nudging his horse forward, he unsheathed his daggers, and with one quick gesture offered both, hilts first across his forearm. "I offer you this in exchange for trade passage to the Admiral. Genuine Castlene daggers, forged 300 years ago. If you would care to listen, I will tell you how I came to bear them."
"No," De Morban raised his hand. "I've no need of priest's trinkets, Castlene or mendicant, or whatever you are. So if you've no other business with the Admiral you'd care to discuss with me, and naught else to offer in trade, let us be done with it."
His guard ranged unobtrusively before us, spreading out, a full 40 men positioning themselves between us and the not-so-distant sea, where I could see now Quintilius Rouse's fleet. To be so near and fail? Perhaps, I thought, we could return after nightfall and gain the fleet. Jocelyn must have thought it too, and shown it.
"The sooner it's done, my friends," de Morban said aloud in his wry tone, "the sooner you can be on your way. I'll give you an escort to the borders of Cushith, that no harm befalls you."
That we didn't double back, he meant. I heard it plain. We had Isandra's ring, of course, which would gain us passage if he were loyal. I thought of showing it to him. But if he were loyal, he wouldn't deny us access to Raus in the first place. And if he were Melisande's ally, there had to be another way. House Morban was not so old as the Shahrazai in Cushith, but old enough to have attained sovereignty. He was a scion of Cushiel. There was one offer he would consider.
"My lord,"
it is funny how the tones and inflection of Sirius House remain with one. I lifted my head and rode forward to meet his eyes, close enough that he could not fail to see what mine contained.
"My lord, there is somewhat else we may offer in trade for passage."
Quinsel de Morban drew in his breath sharply and his horse danced under him.
"You,"
he said, quieting his mount. His eyes narrowed again.
"Melisande's creature, I thought. But I heard you were condemned for the murder of Roland's poet de Launay."
"No," Jocelyn, realizing belatedly what I'd done, grabbed my arm.
"Fedra, no."
I shook him off, holding de Morban's gaze.
"You know what I am, your grace. You know what I offer. One night, free passage, and no questions."
His eyebrows rose, but otherwise his expression was unchanged.
"In Elowa's city, you could not dictate such terms, Anguisset. Why should I not seek you there? I have coin."
"I own my mark, and I dictate the terms I choose," I said evenly. "I have named my price. From you I will accept no other."
De Morban's gaze strayed to Jocelyn, who sat taut with anguish.
"There was a castling involved, I seem to remember. What would the queen pay for such knowledge?"
His grey eyes returned to me, gauging my reaction.
"Or House Shahrazai, perhaps. Melisande likes to know things."
Somewhere behind me, I could hear Hyacinth muttering in black fury, could feel Jocelyn's wild rage building. We were betrayed, they thought. I had erred. Delaunay used to think such things, too, when I took dangerous risks with a patron. But if I had one confidence, it was in that. Never yet had I misjudged a patron's desire. I did not answer de Morbihan's question, only sat beneath his gaze. "You know what I am, my lord," I thought, "and I am the only one of my kind, the only one born in 3 generations. I am born to serve such as you are. Kushiel's cruel fire runs in your blood, and I alone, kindle to it. Choose now, or never know." The tension mounted between us like heat. At last Quinsel de Morbihan smiled, a smile that sent a shudder the length of my spine.
"What business is it of mine if someone sends Tsingani horse traders, whores and priests to the Queen's admiral?" "Very well. Your offer is accepted."
He bowed, sweeping one arm toward the south.
"I give to your company my hospitality for 1 night. In the morning you may ride to Quintilius Rouse. Is it agreed?" "It is not," Jocelyn began heatedly, while Hyacinth said, "Your Grace, perhaps..."
"Yes," I said loudly, overriding them. "We will draw up the contract in your quarters, Your Grace. Have you a priest to witness?"
Quinsel de Morbihan's face reflected bleak amusement at my caution. "I will send to the Temple of Kushiel on the Isle d'West. Will that suffice?"
"It will."
Thus did we come to enjoy the hospitality of the Duke de Morbihan.
Chapter 65. I have known worse. The castle of Morbihan is set atop a rocky escarpment over the sea, impregnable on 3 sides, and well guarded from the front. It was a cheerless place on a grey day, spring having gained but the most tentative of footholds in this outlying land. Oliver shivered on the ride, Necky's family, even the children, silent and fearful. But de Morbihan's word was good, and he saw to it that they were well housed, the horses stabled. In this he included Hyacinth, who ground his teeth, but did not protest. He would have included Jocelyn as well.
"Your Grace," Jocelyn controlled himself with an effort, "I am oath-sworn to protect my Lady Fedrano Delaunay. Do not ask me to forswear myself."
"So you say," Quinsel de Morbihan looked at Jocelyn's mendicant cloak. "Then again, it is the sort of mindless loyalty a Castellan would voice. Do you actually perform as a mendicant priest?"
After a moment, Jocelyn gave a curt nod.
"Fine, then you may entertain my household."
A couple of de Morbihan's men-at-arms nudged each other, grinning like boys at the prospect. It was the only thing on that journey that made me smile. It had been a long, dull winter in Morbihan, I suspected.
"Yes, Your Grace," Jocelyn bowed, a castellan bow, unthinking.
"Harm her," he said under his voice, "and you will die. That I promise."
"Do you?" De Morbihan raised his brows. "But she was born to be harmed."
At that he turned, summoning his chamberlain. Jocelyn grabbed my arm again, painfully hard.
"Fedra, don't do this. I swear I'll find another way."
"Stop," I laid one hand on his cheek. "Jocelyn, you made Carsiel's choice. You can't keep me from making Nama's." Reaching into my bodice, I fished out Isandra's ring, pulling the chain over my head. "Just keep this safe, will you?" I thought he might protest further, but he took it, his face changing, taking on the impassive expression I'd seen so often in Gunter's steading, and then in Selig's, while he had to watch me serve as bed-slave to our Skaldic masters. But that had been slavery. This was not. De Morbihan had not lied. He sent for a priest who came in the black robes of Kushiel, unmasked, carrying the rod and wheel. She was an older woman, whose look held all the terrible compassion of her kind. De Morbihan treated her with respect, and I saw that he would honour our contract. For the most part.
"And the signal?" he asked courteously, pen at the ready.
It took me by surprise. I'd nearly forgotten after Skaldia that such things existed. I started to reply, then caught myself. "Perrenwald," I said. It did not seem right any more to use Hyacinth's name. Nor did it summon the safety it once had. De Morbihan nodded, writing it down. The priest put on her bronze mask, taking on Kushiel's face, and set her signet in the hot wax to seal it.
"You know I will ask questions upon your departure," De Morbihan said, passing me the contract for my signature. "Our contract does not bind me from that, nor from questioning Rouse and his men, who are on Morbihan territory."
"Yes, my lord." I wrote my name in a flowing hand, "but questions are dangerous, for they have answers." He looked curiously at me.
"So on our field Delaunay taught you to think. I'd heard as much, though it was hard to credit. There was no thought in your pretty head the night I met you."
No thought, at least, that wasn't connected to the lead in Melisande's hand. I flushed, remembering. De Morbihan nodded to the Cushaline priest, who bowed and departed silently.
"Are you Melisande's creature?"
he asked me, musing. Reaching out, he took up the diamond that lay on my breast, drawing me to him. I stumbled a little, feeling my heart beat speed.
"I thought so then. Now I am not sure. What game is she playing? Tell me this much, at least. Did she send you? Is this some strange ploy of hers, to see where my loyalties lie?"
"No questions, my lord," I whispered, my head spinning. "You have pledged it."
"Yes," he dropped the diamond. "I have."
There are things that one can see in patrons when one serves Narma. I saw it in him, the fear that could cut desire. He had come to doubt since his decision. He had the ill luck to rule a province that contained House Sharazai and all its wiles. I took a step back and made another choice, as rash as the first. "No," I said, and met his startled look. "One answer, my lord, and then you will honour our contract, or I will leave." "No. If I am anyone's creature, it is Delaunay's. And if I am here, it is at his bidding."
"From beyond the grave."
He made a statement, not a question of it.
"He honoured his vow to Prince Roland, I heard. To the grave and beyond."
De Morbihan laid both hands on the table, considering our contract.
"If that is true, then you are here at Isandra's bidding."
I did not answer. "I am here to serve your pleasure, my lord," I said instead, nodding at the contract.
"So you are."
He drew his attention away from it and looked wryly at me.
"It would please me, Fedrino Delaunay, to have you bathed and attired. I've no taste for Tsingani wenches, if you don't mind."
"As my lord wishes," I curtsied. The women of Morbihan were kind enough to me, hiding curiosity behind their habitual silence. They are not a talkative folk, those who dwell in outermost Kushit. I was led away to a bath that was fairly sumptuous, then waited, drying in silken robes, while a seamstress brought in an array of garments to determine what would best fit and suit me. For all its bleakness, Morbihan did not lack for finery. We found a suitable gown, a rich scarlet with a low back, that showed to good advantage my completed mark. I confess I admired myself in the mirror, tucking my hair into a gold mesh caul and turning this way and that to see how the striking black lines of my mark emerged from the base of the gown, rising to the finial, gazing at my face to see how the gown's colour brought out the deep bistre of my eyes, the scarlet mote of Kushiel's dart. I suppose I should have dreaded this assignation, it is true. It was necessity that forced it upon me. But I had been pledged since the first bloom of womanhood to the service of Narma, and in a way I cannot voice, a deep pleasure pervaded me at the thought of practicing my art. I thought of Jocelyn and of Hyacinth, and guilt wormed cold within me. I thought of Gunter and Voldemar Selig, and shame made me small. And yet,
I remembered my vows in the temple of Nama, the offering dove quivering in my hands.
This was what I was. What strength I possessed, it stemmed from this.
Quinsel de Morban received me in his garden, something I never would have suspected from either the man or the place. It was an inner sanctum, like Delaunay's, like I had known in the night court, only vaster. It was shielded from the elements, warmed by a dozen braziers and torches, with mirrors set to gather the sun's heat when it availed, and scrims of sheerest silk that could be drawn across the open roof to protect the delicate flora. In all defiance of the early spring chill, a riot of flowers bloomed. Spikenard and foxglove, azalea, lady's slipper, and love not lost, orchids and phlox, lavender and roses.
"You are pleased," de Morban said softly.
He stood beside a small fountain awaiting me. His eyes drank in the sight of me.
"It costs me thousands of ducats to maintain this place. I have one master gardener from Lanyas and one from Namar, and they are ever at odds with each other. But I reckon it worth the cost. I am Dangeline, so we count the cost of pleasure."
He reached out one hand for me.
"So I count your cost."
I went to him unhesitatingly. He drew me against him, his lean body clad in black velvet doublet and breeches, with the de Morban crest on his shoulder. I felt the dark tide of desire loose in my marrow, as one hand clasped hard on my buttocks, pressing me to him, and the other grasped the nape of my neck, entangled in the mesh caul, drawing my head back. He kissed me, then, hard and ruthlessly. I had chosen this, for what had happened before, for Melisande, for Scaldi. I had repented, I had been scourged. With a relief so profound it was like pain, I surrendered to it, to this Cushaline lord with his strong, cruel hands. Lifting his head, Quinsel de Morban looked at me with something like awe.
"It's true," he whispered, "what they say. Cushiel's dart. It's all true."
"Yes, my lord," I murmured. If he'd told me the moon was locked in his stables, I'd have said the same at that moment. De Morban released me, turning away to pluck a great silvery rose, mindful of its thorns.
"You see this?"
he asked, placing it in my hand and folding my fingers about the stem.
"It exists nowhere else. My Namarese gardener bred it. Namar Star, he calls it."
His hand was still around mine.
He closed it, tightening my clutch on the stem. Thorns pierced my skin, and I gasped, my bones turning to water.
The silvery rose blossomed between us, fragrant in the torch-lit night air, while blood ran, drop by slow drop, from my fist. De Morban's gaze held me pinioned, his body close, rigid phallus pressed against my belly. He released my hand, and I sank to my knees, divining his desire, unfastening his breeches, the rose falling forgotten, as I took him in my hand, his hard-veined and throbbing phallus slick with my own warm blood, and then into my mouth. All around us, his unlikely garden opened onto the night, as I performed the longis mort, until he drew away at the end, spending himself on me, in the garden, drops of milky fluid lying on my skin, on the dark leaves and silken petals, pearlescent and salty. He groaned with pleasure, then gazed down at me, freeing my hair from the caul with a harsh twist, so that it cascaded about my shoulders and down my back.
"Dinner," he said, catching his breath. "And then I will show you my pleasure chamber, little Anguissette."
On my knees, I touched the tip of my tongue to my lips, catching a drop of his seed. Pleasure chamber. My very skin shivered, anticipating the lash. "As you wish, my lord," I whispered. It is not needful, I think, to detail what befell thereafter. It was a good meal, a very good one indeed, for de Morban's cooks are the equal of his gardeners. We had fresh seafood, baby squid so new-caught they fairly squirmed,
cooked in their own inky juices. And after that, a stuffed turbot that I weep to remember, with rice and rare spices. 3 wines from the Lusande Valley, and a dish with apples. I cannot recall it now. De Morban's eyes were on me through the whole of it, keen and grey and knowing. He had the measure of it now, what I was. How desire ran like a fever in my blood.
"Why did Isandra send you?" he asked softly, testing.
I pushed my chair back from the table, struggling to my feet, fighting the dark blood tide. Somewhere, I thought, listening, somewhere Jocelyn is telling tales to de Morban's houseguard. I clung to the memory of him like a talisman, his deadly dance with Selig Thanes in a driving snowstorm, remembrance cooling my blood, shaking my head.
"No questions," de Morban said quickly. "No questions. Phaedra, forgive me. Sit."
"You have sworn it in Kushiel's name," I murmured, but I sat. He reached across the table, tracing the line of my brow above my left eye, the dart-stricken one. Calluses, a warrior duke's fingertips.
"In Kushiel's name," he agreed.
So it began. It ended as it always does with such things. He had a full pleasure chamber and flagellary, the Duke de Morban, and he took me there, in the cool depths of the earth beneath his castle, at the outermost edge of Terre d'Ange, setting the torches ablaze until it might as well have been Kushiel's domain, wringing me limp with blood and sweat, his face distorted behind the lash, and the sound of my own voice, begging, pleading, as he rode me at the end, bestriding me like a colossus. He used flechettes, too. I hadn't counted on that. 1,000 deaths of agony and pleasure I died there in Quinsel de Morban's chamber. He was good, better almost than any patron I had known, when at last he laid civility aside for violent pleasure, the mask of lust obscuring his features. He was a Cushaline. It was in his blood. He wanted, oh, Elowa, he wanted, to hear me give the signal. If he gave up his questions, it was for that, waiting. And if I had given it, I would have answered. But I had given the signal to one patron only, who had sundered me from myself. Quinsel de Morban could command me, shuddering, to give up my very flesh, quivering in abject climax. He could, and he did, snarling with victory. Not my signal. And in the end, his exhaustion defeated us both.
"Take care of her," he bid his servants, weariness and profound satisfaction draining his voice, shrugging into silk robes, bowing in my direction. "Treat her gently."
They did, I trust. I don't remember it in truth. I saw faces approach awe-stricken. They understand in Kushith what it is to serve Kushiel. I hurt in every part of me, and I was content. I closed my eyes, then, and let the deeper tide of unconsciousness claim me. In the morning I woke aching and sore, in clean linen sheets, with stiff red bloodstains. De Morban's personal physician entered the room before I'd risen, eyes averted. He'd tended to me the night before, I understood. He checked such dressings as he'd applied, and rubbed salve into those wheels that had opened in the night and bled. I felt better before he was done, and dismissed him. Quinsel had provided new clothing for me. Fine stuff, fit for travel, but of a good quality, such as Kushaline noblewomen wear. I thanked him when we breakfasted together.
"I thought mayhap you'd no further need of your Tsingani rags," he said, grey eyes gleaming.
I raised my eyebrows, knowing it was best not to reply.
"Here,"
he said then brusquely, and pushed something across the table. It was a ring, a flawless circle of black pearls set in silver, small and immaculate.
"It is customary, is it not, to give a patron gift?"
De Morban's mouth quirked wryly.
"It was my mother's. I'd planned on giving it to my wife. But there are many women among whom to choose for a bride, and I do not think I shall meet another Anguisette. Wear it, then, and think of me sometime. I hope you will not give up Narmar's service altogether, Phaedra no Delaunay.
There are times to demur and times not. This was not such a time. I slid the ring onto my finger and bowed my head to the Duke de Morbihan. "When I think of you, my lord," I said, "I will think well." He toyed with items on the table, restless and curious.
"I shall await with great interest the resolution of the mystery you pose me," he said. "Pray that I do not regret my choice in this matter."
In truth, I did not know. All I had fathomed in our congress was that he had not determined where his loyalties lay. He was the sovereign Duke of Cushith. Whether the province stood with the crown or against it was his to decide. In the end, I answered him simply. "Your Grace," I said, "I pray it too." So we left it, crossed blades, unsure and unwary. He rang a bell and had Jocelyn summoned, who burst into the room in a fury of agitation, eyes red-rimmed and sleepless, glaring accusations and fear at me. I looked mildly at him over the rim of a teacup.
"Are you disappointed, Carceline?" Quinsel de Morbihan asked, amused. "I am sorry. I would be curious, I confess, to try the mettle of one of your kind."
Jocelyn shot him a look then that said he would be glad to try it any time, any place, kneeling at my side.
"Is it true, then? You're all right, Phaedra?"
"His Grace de Morbihan honored his contract," I said, looking at Quinsel, absently twisting the ring on my finger. It was easier than meeting Jocelyn's eyes, for he would see the deep languor in my bones and disapprove in his uniquely Castelline manner. "And we are free to go, then, Your Grace?" Quinsel de Morbihan made a face at once frustrated and fulfilled. He gestured with one hand, setting us free, calling his servants to witness.
"Our contract is complete," he said, brusque and formal. "You have free passage throughout Morbihan, where you will. To the Royal Fleet and beyond."
He paused, then added,
"One day, Phaedra. I give you one day, before I decide if it behooves me to question the Queen's Admiral."
"Thank you, Your Grace."
Chapter 66. Jocelyn walked quickly through the stone halls of Morbihan Castle, and I winced, hurrying to keep up. He paused to wait for me, the line of his jaw tight.
"Are you fit to ride?" he asked abruptly.
"I'll manage." The words came out through gritted teeth. Jocelyn looked at me and shook his head, setting out at a pace only slightly slower.
"I will never understand," he said, gaze fixed forward as he strode, "why you do what you do and call it pleasure."
"With your temper, you should."
That stopped him in his tracks, and he stared at me in shock, blue eyes wide. "I do not have a temper, and what does that have to do with it?"
"You have a terrible temper, Jocelyn Verai. You've just buried it in Castelline discipline." I rotated my arm, rubbing my shoulder where the joint ached. De Morbihan's stocks had been made for a taller person. "And not all that well," I added. "I've seen it, Jocelyn. I've seen you lose it, against the Scaldi. I've seen you fight like a cornered wolf when you had no chance of winning. What's it like, that instant when you let it go, when you lash out with everything in you, knowing you're going to be beaten to the ground? Is it a relief to surrender to that?"
"Yes," he said softly, and looked away.
"Well," something snapped faintly in my shoulder, and the soreness eased. "Imagine that relief compounding 10 times, 100 times, with every blow, through pain, through agony, to become a pleasure so great and awful it fixes you like a spear." I shook my arm, finding it better. "Then," I said, "you will understand a little bit what it is to serve Cushiel." He listened and heard, then looked somberly at me.
"Even among the Scaldi?"
"No." I shook my head, my voice turning hard. "That was different. I did not choose it. That is what it is, I think, to be used by an immortal."
"Cushiel's dart."
Something in the way he said it made me think of one-eyed Loder, the wild priest of Odin. Jocelyn shuddered inexplicably.
Come on, we'd best be off. One day, he said. Will he keep his word?
Yes, I said. For a day.
Here.
He drew Isandra's ring on its chain over his head.
She trusted it to your keeping.
I took it back without comment, and we hurried onward. In the courtyard we met with Hyacinth and the Tsingani, a roil of disorderly activity, as adults, children, and horses alike strained with eagerness to be on the open road. Tsingani do not like to sleep in stone walls, reckoning it unlucky. Neki's brother-in-law finished hitching the team, jerking his chin toward the gate.
"Let's go, Rinkeni Chavo, before the Sea Kralis changes his mind," he said impatiently, looking to Hyacinth as our leader.
Hyacinth glanced inquiringly at me. "I'm fine," I said, swinging into the saddle and managing to suppress a grimace. "We've only one day. Let's ride." De Morban's men-at-arms watched us go, a few shouting and laughing. A few friendly calls were directed at Jocelyn, who acknowledged them with a slight smile and a bow. "You really did entertain them," I said. He shrugged.
"What else was I to do? Go mad worrying about you? Anyway, it's good practice."
"I think you enjoy it," I teased him, my heart growing lighter as the walls of Morban Castle fell steadily behind us.
"I wouldn't go that far."
His tone was reserved, but the ghost of a smile still hovered at one corner of his mouth. The day had dawned fine and clear, a hint of damp warmth in the brisk air, the sky above bearing only a few scudding clouds. We followed a winding coastal road, the blue-grey sea crashing on the rocks below us, sometimes near enough to send a plume of spray over our party. Seagulls wheeled overhead, filling the morning with their raucous cries. I strained to see across the waters and catch a glimpse of distant Alba, but we were too far here. In Azal, they say, one can see the white cliffs across the strait. We'd been no more than an hour upon the road when we saw them, coming around a high outcropping. There below us, a narrow bay cut into the coast, with a flat sandy beach skirting it. One of the Tsingani outriders gave the cry, and the children boiled out of the wagon, jumping and pointing. The Queen's fleet was anchored in the mouth of the bay, 40-some ships, their masts bobbing against the horizon. The sails were lashed, but they flew the Courcelle pennant, the silver swan snapping in the sea breeze. It was a beautiful sight, and on the beach a vast encampment was set, with the figures of sailors made small by our height, moving to and fro. There must have been 100 oar boats beached there, while others dared the plunging waves, heading out to or back from the fleet. We had found Quintilius Rouse. "Come on!" Hyacinth shouted, waving us onward. The Tsingani caught our exhilaration as we began our descent, scrambling incautiously down the steep, declining road. Rouse's men spotted us well before we reached the bottom, assembling in mass, hands hovering over sword hilts and bemused expressions on their faces. Near to the bottom our impatience took its toll. The wagon, lurching too fast, ran off the road and got hung up on a ridge. The racket of scared, squalling Tsingani children bid fair to outdo the gulls. Gisela and her sister, sighing, counted heads and checked limbs, while Neki and the men rode back shame-faced to prod at the wagon and mutter. "Go ahead, Javi," Gisela said kindly to me, adjusting the scarf on her head and watching the Tsingani men with a practiced eye. "They'll get it loose. You and the others go make the trade. Go make a name for Neki's Kumpania, who rode to the outermost west for gold." I nodded, gathering Jocelyn and Hyacinth. We picked our way down the remainder of the cliff road carefully. By the time we reached bottom, the Admiral himself had arrived, a burly, imposing figure who parted a path through his men as surely as the prow of one of his ships.
"What vagabonds have we here?"
he bellowed, roaring out the question, bright blue eyes squinting.
"Eloa's balls! Have the travellers decided to push their long road across the sea?"
He was not, like Gaspar Trevelyan, nearly an uncle to me, but he was Delaunay's friend and a figure from my childhood, and unexpected tears choked me. "My Lord Admiral," I managed, dismounting and curtsying with some difficulty. "My Lord Admiral, I bear a message from the Queen." I looked up then, and he looked down, and an expression of astonishment split his scarred face.
"By the 10,000 devils of Kebel-e-Makard," he thundered, causing his men to grin and the nearest to cover their ears. "Delaunay's whelp!"
And with that he grabbed me in a bone-cracking embrace that drove the wind from my lungs, leaving me unable to gasp with pain as his mighty arms enfolded my fresh-welted back.
"What in seven hells are you doing here, girl?"
he asked when he released me.
"I thought those justice-mad idiots in the city convicted you of murder."
"They did," I said, wheezing. That's one of the reasons I'm here and not there." Quintilius Rouse looked calculatingly at me, then at the Tsingani wagon stuck on the cliff road.
"Go help them down," he said to a handful of his men, who set out grumbling. "What's the other?" he asked me.
I regained my breath. "I speak Kruinya."
"Ah."
One long syllable and a gleam of understanding in his shrewd eyes.
"Come along, then. We've got a great deal to discuss."
He looked at Hyacinth and Jocelyn.
"You too, I suppose?"
Both of them bowed.
"Let's to it, then."
He glanced up the cliff road once more, rubbing his chin.
"Glad you brought them. I could use a few horse, you know."
"We were counting on it," Hyacinth said. The Queen's Admiral received us in his tent, which was large, mainly to hold the vast number of chests filled with maps and books that he had accumulated, that and treasure, which he had in abundance.
"No time to stow it or even buy a respectable mistress," he grumbled, sweeping aside a king's ransom of jewellery from atop one of the chests. "Sit, and tell me why you are here. Starting at the beginning. Who killed Anarfiel Delaunay?"
We told him, Jocelyn and I, starting at the beginning in the Marquist's shop.
"My lad Aelric Letha made it back with his skin whole," Rouse interrupted us. "I knew as much. Swy I knew it wasn't you, child, or the Castellan either. That and the fact you always doted on him like a babe on a sugar tit. Delaunay was already being watched. So who was it?"
"Isidore d'Eglamour," I said, then took a deep breath and told him the rest. This time he listened without interruption, his face growing dark with outrage. When we were done, he sat gathering fury like a thunderstorm. Until it broke, and he roared about his tent, raging, breaking and throwing things. One of his men poked in his head, then hastily withdrew it as a piece of crockery came flying his way. When it was over, Quintilius Rouse sighed.
"Too much to ask that you're lying, I suppose," he asked hopefully.
I shook my head and reached for Isandra's ring, showed it to him lying on my palm. "She gave me this, to show you, and to give to the Prince of the Kruinya."
"Roland's ring."
The Admiral gave it a cursory examination and heaved another sigh.
"Oh, I know it all right. No, there's no hope for it. But I don't mind telling you, I'd rather bring my fleet up coast and sail up the Rhenus, set us in place to crack Scaldy skulls, and Carmeline come to it, than go chasing off on a fool's errand to Alba."
"What if it's not a fool's errand?" I argued. Quintilius Rouse fixed me with his shrewd gaze.
"We tried it before, you know, sailing the long way round from Lower Siobhal, going leagues out of our way to avoid the straits, to the far shores of Alba. Know what we met? 1,000 lime-haired Dalriada, shrieking curses and casting spears. We never even made landfall."
"How many ships?" Hyacinth asked abruptly.
15, Rouse replied curiously.
"You need one. Only one." Hyacinth swallowed as if the words pained him. "That's what I saw, when Isandra asked me to speak the Dromond. One ship." Another mighty sigh.
"A night-blooming flower, a Tsingano witch-boy, and, a costling whatever. This is what Isandra sends me. I must be mad.
Quintilius Rouse rumpled his hair, a tangle half-braided mane of reddish-brown.
What do you say, Carceline?
Jocelyn bowed. My Lord Admiral, I say that whatever you choose, you must do it quickly, because by tomorrow afternoon the Duke de Morban will be here asking questions.
Morban!
It was uttered in tones of disgust.
He's got me penned in like a fox with chickens. How'd you get past him anyway? Elric scarce made it through, and de Morban's gotten more suspicious since the king died.
Hyacinth looked at me. Jocelyn looked at me. I raised my eyebrows. Nama's way.
Ah, Rouse grinned. Delaunay's pupil to the end. Well, then I must decide, and quickly. Too much to ask, I suppose, that the queen has a plan for passing elder brother.
Dismayed, I shook my head. I thought she would have passage, my lord. You treated with him, you won an answer. When the Black Boar rules in Alba.
And nigh founded to gain it, Quintilius Rouse scratched his chin. I've no right of passage, child. That answer was all I gained. That, and the right to cling to my wretched life. Why do you think Delaunay was working so hard to unravel the mystery of him? And the white-haired lad Alcuin?
Outside the tent, on the beach, the sound of fiddles and a tambour sounded our depressed silence, punctuated by rhythmic clapping from the sailors. Hyacinth stirred. My lord, we promised the Tsingani a great trade, for the horses they bring. They've done us fair service as disguise. It worked all the way to Morban.
Might as well.
The admiral grasped a handful of Arcadian treasure, long strands of rubies and seed-pearls spilling from his brawny clutch.
I've naught better to do with this, it seems, and like to rest on the bottom of the streets ere I come to spend it. We'll set 'em back on the long road with something to boast of, eh?
I am no gem merchant to gauge the worth of the wealth Quintilius Rouse bestowed on Necky's family, nor a horse-trader to guess at the value of what he got in trade. Whatever it was enough that the Tsingani stretched their eyes to see it, and fell into their most obsequious manner, swearing to bless his name at every crossroads. It had taken some time to get the wagon onto the beach and conclude the deal, and dusk was falling when it was done. The Tsingani would stay that night and depart in the morning. They set up their camp with their usual efficiency, and I noticed Gisella doing a good trade in spices with the d'Angeline sailors, weary of bland fish stew. Jocelyn entertained the children with one last mendicant's tale as the stars emerged, benign and distant, over the vast, surging ocean. Hyacinth brought me with him to make his farewell to Necky. "May the Lungo Drom prosper you, Tseroman of Necky's Kumpania," he said, bowing formally. "You have been a good comrade on the way." Necky stroked the tips of his moustache, twiddling them to elegant points. "And you," he added, and grinned.
"Rin kenny chavo."
He looked solemn then, with one of those quick shifts of emotion of which the Tsingani are masters.
"Chavo, I don't know if it's true that you speak the Dromond or not. I do not care. When people say Manoj has no grandson, I will say it is untrue. I will speak your name and remember it. In my Kumpania, your name will always be spoken."
"Thank you," Hyacinth clasped his wrist, hard and firm, "and yours."
"The great trade of outermost west."
Necky gazed at the sea, the waves breaking on the shore.
"It is true. It will make our love."
He bowed to me.
"And you, Chavi, who was never born in a back alley, else I am a fool. We will remember you, too."
"Thank you." I kissed him on the cheek. "Be kind to women without Larkster, then, if you would remember me."
"I will remember you in my dreams."
His white grin flashed, and he turned to stride back to his family, waving a last farewell. "It's not too late," I said to Hyacinth. He gazed out at the sea, rippling silver in the dusk. "What did Rouse say? Maybe he's right.
The long road doesn't end where the sea begins. If anyone is to cross it, it should be the Prince of Travellers, yes?
Yes, I said, tucking one hand around his arm. We watched the sea together, endless and amazing, moving without cease. If we're not still here when De Morbihan comes, I added, spotting the unmistakable figure of Quintilius Rouse pacing the shore, pausing and staring out at his fleet.
No, Hyacinth said certainly. He'll go. He has to. One ship. I saw it.
He was silent a moment, then asked drolly,
And how was the dear Duke De Morbihan, anyway?
You really want to know? I glanced up at his starlit face.
He laughed. Why not? I always did.
Good, I said, looking back at the sea. The Duke De Morbihan was very, very good.
I thought so. You had that look.
Hyacinth wound a lock of my hair around one finger.
I'm not afraid of it, you know, he said softly. What you are.
No, I touched Melisande's diamond. I am. We went back then to Rouse's encampment, and I left Hyacinth to go speak with the Admiral, still pacing the shoreline like an angry lion, wisely avoided by his men. The gibbous moon had arisen by that time, standing overhead to set a shining path across the sea, as if to show where the long road lay.
"My lord," I said, kneeling near him. The sand was cool and damp beneath me. Quintilius Rouse turned on me, glaring.
"Ah, don't waste your night court decorum on me, girl. I've a hard choice to make here."
"Yes, my lord," I said, remaining on my knees. "To obey the crown or not?"
"It's not that."
His voice rose above the sound of the waves, then he lowered it, squatting in front of me.
"Listen, child. Isonde de la Courcelle's loyal to the land, and she's the making of a good queen. I know it, and De Launay knew it, and Gaspard Trevelyan too. That's why we aided her. And it would be a grand thing, this alliance, if it stood a chance of happening. But the chance is precious slim, and the reality is, if you tell me true, that we face civil war and Scaldian invasion all at once. So I must ask myself, you see, where can I do the most good? On a harebrained mission nigh doomed to fail, or fighting for my country? I've over 40 ships and nigh 1,000 men here, hand-picked, who can fight at sea or on land. Eloise balls they whip the Acadians, who fight like 10,000 devils. Isonde de la Courcelle is young and untried, and knows little yet of statecraft, and nothing of war. How am I best to aid her? By obeying or defying?
Kneeling, abeant, as I had been taught since earliest childhood, I lifted my face and gazed at him.
You have nothing, I said softly. Quintilius Rouse stared at me.
Do you think your ships will make a difference in a land battle? Do you think your men will count for aught?
My Lord Admiral, I have seen the Scaldi, and they number more than the grains of sand on this beach.
A few hundred men. I scooped up a handful of sand and let it trickle through my fingers.
How do you wish to die, Admiral?
We are d'Angeline, at the hands of numbers or dreams.
With a sound of disgust, Quintilius Rouse rose and turned his back on me, standing at the verge of the gently breaking waves.
You're as bad as your master, he muttered, scarce audible amid the sea sounds. Worse. At least he didn't ply his words from a courtesan's lips.
I remained silent. Quintilius Rouse sighed.
Elder brother, have mercy on us. We'll sail at dawn.
Chapter 67. And so we did. It was somewhat later than dawn, truth be told, when we set out in the oar-boat for Rouse's flagship. Once he'd made up his mind, the Admiral was nothing but efficiency, but there were a great many orders to be delegated before we left. These I tried to follow as best I could, but Quintilius Rouse was in no mind to be tailed by De Launay's anguissette, so all I caught was a confused impression. He would leave his lieutenant in charge, with orders to implement a shore brigade guarding their borders. A quarter of the ships would sail up coast to Azal and find berth at Trevelyan, held loyal by Guillain de Sommerville, and send word to Isandre. If royal couriers could not make it through Morban, they could send word through Trevelyan. As for the rest, they would do their best to hold off de Morban's inquiry and sound out his loyalty. For de Morban had a fleet of his own. I'd not known that, and if he turned traitor he could use it to sail north and harry the whole of the Azalis coast, forcing them to turn their attentions away from the flatlands and guarding the Rhenus. It was a fair bewilderment of possibilities and strategies. I had never appreciated, until his death, the narrow and dangerous path de Launay trod among his allies and enemies. Then again, I thought, nor had he, not entirely. Melisande had played a deeper game and blinded him to Deglamour's betrayal. It was only my ill luck to have stumbled upon it. And now I was playing an even deeper game that she had not yet guessed. Thinking on it, I shuddered. Cushiel's dart cast against the blood of his line. Whatever befell us on the waters, at least it took me further away from her. I did not trust myself after seeing her at the Hippocamp. I had withheld the signal, it was true, the last time, but I would not trust it a third time. I had come closer than I liked to think with de Morban. It was shock and the numbness of grief that had buffered me that terrible night with Melisande, the night of de Launay and Alcuin's death, and even then it had been so close. Another time, I trailed my fingers in the water as the oarsmen set to and the shore grew distant behind us. Another time it would be different, and Eloa help me, I longed for it. I could not help it, even as I despised her. The edge between love and hate is honed finer than the keenest flechette. She told me something like that once, but I dared not think on such things, with her name so close to my tongue. She told me, too, that it was not my acquiescence that interested her, but my rebellion. That was the thing that set her apart from the others, who failed to see where it lay. That was the thing that terrified me. Well then, if I could not free myself from her sway, I could do that much. I ran one finger under the velvet lead tied about my throat, considering the horizon. Melisande, Shahrazai, wanted to see how far I would run with her line upon me, how far my rebellion would take me. I do not think she reckoned on it taking me to the green and distant shores of Alba. Eloa willing, it might even lead to the unravelling of her subtle and deep-laid plans. So I prayed, facing the forbidding seas, and if I were to die on these deadly waters, I prayed my last thought wouldn't be of her. Though somehow I feared it would. While I occupied myself with these morbid thoughts, Rouse's strong oarsman gained his flagship, scrambling aboard. And then I had no time to dwell on such things, as they lowered rope-ladders for us, and we had to clamber on board, hands and feet slipping on the salt-slickened rope. I count myself agile, but it was no easy feat, learning to balance on the swaying wooden decks of the great ship. A pillar of compassion, Quintilius Rouse laughed at our dismay, striding about with a rolling ease he didn't display on dry land. He shouted orders as he strode, obeyed with alacrity, and we came to see quickly, all of us, why he was the Royal Admiral. He gave us unto the charge of his second-in-command, wiry, sharp-eyed Jean Marchand, who showed us to a cabin with four hammocks slung from the ceiling. By the time we had stowed such gear as we brought, Quintilius was giving orders to hoist sail. I freely confess, boats are a great mystery to me. Before yesterday I'd never even glimpsed the sea, let alone set sail upon it. I cannot begin to fathom the myriad tasks the sailors performed, swarming up and down the masts, lashing and unlashing ropes in bewildering profusion, cranking a chain that raised the anchor, massive and dripping. All I know is that Quintilius Rouse gave commands, and they obeyed. Some 30 men went below decks to set to at the oars, and the great flagship turned its prow slowly, swinging away from land and toward the open sea. And then the sails rose, steady and majestic, deep blue with the Courcelle swan, three in a row, the greatest at the center, with smaller sails fore and aft. The wind filled them, and they bellied out, snapping, setting the silver swan aflight. It happens faster than one imagines. One minute the ship is turning slowly, inching through its own backwater, oars beating the sea into a seemingly futile roil. And then, suddenly, the waves are slipping past, lapping at the sides with ever-increasing speed. A cheer arose from the sailors, and Quintilius Rouse breached a keg of wine for toasts all around. It is tradition, I learned later, at the start of each voyage. In this we shared. Hyacinth tossed his down, gazing about him exuberantly. I sipped mine, finding it warming against the chilly wind. Jocelyn stared into his mug and looked rather green.
"I don't think I'm a sailor," he murmured.
Quintilius Rouse, strolling past, clapped him on the shoulder.
"Drink it, lad," he said heartily. "If it comes back up, so be it. Just bend over the side and give your toll to the Lord of the Deeps."
It proved to be prophetic advice. I winced with sympathy as Jocelyn clutched the railing and leaned over, retching. Hyacinth grinned.
"Castlings aren't fit for the long road," he said. "Not when it extends over sea.